Welcome. Another beautiful day in the village, correct?
Yes.
So, well, welcome back, Hal. Two housekeeping things. If you missed yesterday or didn't get, here's a copy of the handout from yesterday, and I can make more if you need more. And then on the music standard of days, and again, I'll be watched for that. So we go to 3:30, but there is a nice half hour wedge between that and lunch, so if we, for dinner, excuse me, so Hal can use that time as you wish it. So welcome
okay,
back, Hal.
Thanks. Yeah, so let's just do the time thing first. I want to this session to be substantially more interactive than our last session, although I really appreciated the way you all spoke right up last time. But because we have some ambitions for longer term thinking around this, I'm wanting us to hear from you a little bit more thoroughly today. So I was thinking that it was just 2:30 to 3:30. Does anyone need me to continue to think that it's just 2:30 to 3:30? Oh, I kind of put that person on the spot. I'm sorry. So I'm thinking that probably at least from 3:15 to 3:45 will be quite interactive, and maybe even from 3 to 3:45 will be quite interactive. And feel free to walk out anytime. But I'd love to us to be in conversation for that hour and 15 minutes. So I noticed that there's some of you are weren't here last time, so just let me do a little introduction and to say that I have a handout that probably will be useful to us today. And so basically what I have in the first paragraph, I won't read as I did last time, but just to say that one of the things I'm hoping for us to do this weekend is to think about two words that I don't know the difference between. I should, but I don't. And that's worship and ritual. I'm assuming that they have overlapping meanings and that we'll sort it out with each other as we go along. If there are important differences between those two words in your understanding, I can tell you that in my understanding, it's all mixed up. I hope that's not reassuring. So the first thing we did last time is to say, so ritual and worship have a long history in humankind. You know, probably a good 500,000 years, right? In which people have been doing something like ritual and worship. So it may be one of the things that we as a species know how best to do. And it's a thing that in Western society is in crisis in the last century. So an interesting time to think about that. Secondly, some of us have been talking over in the fall about the possibility that here at Holden in the next 6 months, we'll have some ongoing study, conversation, and experimentation about worship / ritual. I'm going to teach twice in the summer on this. Whether it is sort of like what we do this weekend or not is not yet clear, depending on all of the things we learned and all of the things that went wrong this weekend. And I don't know either right now. So just to say that I'm assuming that this is for some of us won't be here in the summer, some of us will be. There'll probably be some important things happen between the summer and now relative to what one might do and what one might think about ritual and worship at Holden and beyond. Finally, I want to just double check on a little bit of who we are. I want to say that I assume in our conversation this weekend that not everyone in the room is Christian, and I'm really glad for that. I think, from my understanding, that's healthy for Holden in the long term. And I want you also to know that I understand that Holden has significant Christian tradition and input. And I'm glad for that, too. Just a word or two about me, and this is mainly for you to know when I'm feeding you some line or don't know as much as I'm claiming, is that I've been bivocational all my adult life. I've been a professor of New Testament, but have taught quite a bit of worship. I was one of the faculty leaders at Union Theological Seminary in worship as well. And I have been the entire time an active United Methodist pastor. I have found myself thinking that worship and ritual are the most important things in our time about being spiritual and being Christian. I'm a Christian whether I want to be or not. You couldn't squeeze that out of me. Sometimes I wish you could. I have learned a lot about powerful, helpful, loving worship from people who are not in any kind of Christian status. So that is part of why I'm so convinced that it's not a Christian enterprise that we're going to be talking about in some exclusive way. You need to know that partly because of what happened to me as a New Testament scholar, I became a scholar also of what one calls ritual theory. And that's basically a way of thinking about what ritual and worship are in a big frame and from a relatively critical perspective. By critical meaning analytical. So one of the things that I've learned most about, in addition to learning worship, being somebody who prays and dances and everything in worship myself, one of the things I've learned is that over the long haul, there's a way of thinking helpfully about worship and ritual that says it's a human enterprise. I don't mean to cut God out of that, but I mean to say that one of the primary ways that people are thinking about what worship and ritual are for humans in constructive ways is by looking at what humans do in it, how humans have agency in it, and how humans don't have agency in it. It also points very strongly to the point of view that most worship and ritual, I don't want to say all, but most, is deeply collective. All right, I'm just saying that to reassure myself that you know what I left out of important things right now, and you know where my extra influences and extra ignorance happen. Okay, so those are preliminaries. Anybody wanna say something in response to any of that? Thanks. So I think that it was a steep enough incline yesterday in what we did. I could see shock on some of your faces, and pleasure. that I'm going to take a few minutes for us to re-look at that. I don't have any slides today. Mm-hmm. I did yesterday and I loved them. But I want to see if I can say with you what some things that we were pointing to yesterday, and see if that's clear, see if it needs some protest or rethinking. So without pictures and without stories, which was my main teaching method yesterday, I want to have you look with me on in the second paragraph, which says, reviewing conversation one, before we get to conversation two. So the first almost sentence there is what I think I was doing with you, and hoping you were sort of with me, was I was thinking about worship / ritual as a particular kind of social intelligence that intuitively plays with differences and change. A particular kind of social intelligence that intuitively plays with differences and change. I could, retell you the stories yesterday and how I was working on that, but I want you to know that that's what I thought I was doing, and to hear what you think about that after I look at the next three lines. I think that what we saw yesterday, when we looked at particular big-time worship / ritual, was an activity that was primarily indirect, playful, had hidden transcripts. Let me say just a little bit about those of you, for those of you who don't know the work of James C. Scott. So James C. Scott says that all over in the small settings, mostly rural settings, or neighborhood settings, or town settings, you have people doing what he would call ritual and worship, and he calls it hidden transcripts. So he says, when a local theater group gets together and presents a play in the park, what they're doing is inviting a kind of being together, and what they're saying is not what they want to say, because what they want to say is too scary, powerful, and wonderful to say directly. So a hidden transcript is something that is performative for a bunch of open-ended human endeavors and groups that is good enough at getting to the deep stuff that it knows that it can't say it directly, otherwise it would make people too happy to think straight or too sad to do anything. So indirect, playful, hidden transcripts, not clear transcripts, implicit, impractical, imaginative, energy, emotion, affect, awe, is the kind of thing that I'm expecting us to get a chance to think together about. Finally, on the third line there in the reviewing, worship and ritual are rarely logical, rational, analytical, explicit, or ideational. All those thinky things that people do, and we're glad they do them, end up being inefficient in getting at the deep levels of community and understanding that ritual and worship like to do. Okay, that's another mouthful that I thought I sort of put on slides and things. But let me see what thoughts, protests, or questions you might have about what about that series of words that I didn't say yesterday.
Well, I think it's, I'm intrigued by your use of the word intelligence, because if you were to ask people to define that, you might use some of these words that you say are rare. So why did you use intelligence versus something else? Social activity, a social action, social response.
I think that by and large, worship and ritual go at things that are really important, but scary and powerful. So in other words, we need to learn to have intelligence about it. And I think that what humans have learned is you can't say those things directly. Either someone won't hear them, or they'll be have too many positive and negative emotions to do anything with them. Is that close to a beginning answer?
Yeah.
Just as you were talking, I was thinking what I think of as kind of spontaneous ritual that also can be worship is when something devastating happens, and that night there's candlelight vigil.
Yeah, exactly. And there, and I guess that helps me say also that although human agency is really strong in all ritual and worship, you can almost never point to who did it. In other words, the power of ritual and worship has to do with something that might take three generations to put together implicitly. So how to do? In other words, I've been in those candlelight stuff, and I've seen people learn how to best be there together in that way. And I've seen generations teach one another to do it and or unlearn how to do it when the scene changes or where the circumstances change it.
Now,
yes.
You say a little bit more about the hidden transcripts.
Yeah.
I understand that. So you're kind of pushing like a hidden agenda sort of thing, or underlying that?
Oh, that's a wonderful question that I may not know how to answer. So hidden agenda assumes a kind of agency that I think can't happen in worship. In other words, I don't think the designers ever succeed if they've got a real plan. But I think that over a long haul in the emergence of ritual and worship, a collectivity of lived life knits things together, but no one completely knows that they got knit together and how they got together. So, so for instance, when something wonderful or terrible happened, many groups have learned how to do that, and that's almost always ritual or worship. But you can hardly, sometimes you have some worship leaders who say, yeah, and then I think we'll do this, or then we did that. But what they won't notice is that that's always interactive and changing just a little bit to help, because if your worship almost always have multiple agencies and producers from all over the place. Did I hear what you were?
Yeah, I think okay. That makes sense.
Okay, well, I see a wonderfully and puzzledly buzzing, as a puzzle, people with their mouths open and leaning forward. Okay, all right. So now what I want to do for our active time together is to think about the way worship and ritual in Western cultures with a concentration on Christianity, for better or for worse, in the last century, and especially for us to talk about how the ability for Western cultures to do ritual and worship well is decreasing, and people are walking away from it. So I want us to think about that together. And so I've got this mostly written down, and one of the reasons I told you who I have been in this regard is so that you can see where I'm wrong in what I've written down. And I don't want you to kind of, I don't care whether I'm wrong. I wish I were right on some of this. But so please, when you see something else going on in the topic, please add what you see and critique what I see. I'm aiming for us pretty quickly for me to ask a question like this. What do you know about worship and ritual that has harmed you and helped you? What do you know about worship and ritual that has harmed you and helped you? So that will not work unless we have more than two answers. And I will cut you off when you go on too long because I want to hear other people. Okay, so I've got this relatively preposterous set of historical observations. So this is conversation two, playful analysis of decline of Christian worship in the U.S. since 1900. So, with pure preposterousness, I say, I'm assuming that between 1900 and 1960, American materialism blossomed. That the identifying of the American human with how much they own and how much they had blossomed. And that affected how good or not good people could do ritual.
Why?
I'm not sure. And I may be wrong. Secondly, scientific critique in that period happened. And the part of the critique was against religion and against Christianity. So that was a major cultural development in that first approximate half century. And so there, I mean, they're huge thinkers who went right at worship and calling it stupid or primitive. There was important scientific critique in that period that said, watch out for the religious people, and especially for their ritual. And that affected how good or not good people did worship and ritual. Thanks for being quiet while I just blab on for a minute. There were world wars that damaged humanity in all kinds of ways. I mean, granted, it was sort of a Western world war, But Western, since the Westerners were everywhere with all their big guns and ammunition, it was everywhere. And that damaged people everywhere. It also gave humanity of that time things that they had to process and could have or did process through ritual and worship. But we can't, I think, underestimate the fact that that half century, with all its materialism and power and might, all just about killed itself. And that caused enormous pain. There, at that same time, because those world wars were first of all fought in Europe, Christianity more or less disappeared. Some of us Americans don't know that. Some of us Americans sort of know that because we go and we go to Europe as tourists, and we go to churches, and we see only very few people and mostly very aged people. I lived in Europe for a while. I went to church every week in great big cathedrals, and I worshiped with between 10 and 30 people. That's done. So that affects, that was the heartbeat of worship and ritual for Christians, was Europe. And it's gone. Okay, so that's one thing I want to say about the history of what's happened. Then second, in the 1960s, there were sociocultural revolutions and culture wars that began in earnest in the United States. And that was the beginning of American church decline. And I would need to quickly add synagogue decline. So the 1960s, you look at all of the figures, the 1960s were the places where across the country you find that's when church attendance started declining. 1970 to 2000, there were increasing culture wars. So the ability to do worship and ritual became harder and more controversial. So the long things that humanities learned together became points of debate, anger, and violence. That was the 1970s to the 2000s was the zenith of U.S. evangelism. Evangelicalism, excuse me. And meaning that was when it grew the most and stopped growing. That also helped and hurt the way people did worship and ritual. In that same time, there was the steady and slow decline of so-called U.S. mainline churches. Slow and steady, downward. That also helped some people do better worship and ritual because they were walking away and it didn't help them. And hurt others because it cut the heart out of the communities that were doing it. At least in terms of how many. There was the emergence in that time of non-Christian spiritual practice. I identify here with full-throated support and noting how it impacted Christianity, which wasn't always positive. There was massive learning on how to do ritual and worship from the people of Asia during that period. So just think, in those 30 years, how many people learn to meditate, learn to be together because of the traditions of Asia. Similarly, I think all kinds of ritual and worship started happening in more excited ways because of sports. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. For me, one of the most lively ritual and worship events now that Americans know how to do is pro football. And they dress up in costumes. They sing special songs. They know what the gestures are to help them get through the rest of the week. And then what I only note about 2000 to 2020 is very little, and is just focused on this, mainly because it's hard for us to see ourselves right now. So I don't know how to say much, but I do know how to say that the slow, steady decline of Christian church, as churches have come into a massive decline. The decline of the ability of Christian types to worship has been massively affected by the fact that there are not very many people there, and the people that are there are mad or depressed. And I say that way too broadly, because in other settings I say those, when I look at Christian decline in these two decades, I want to say that about a third of it is growing in very creative ways. Okay, all right, I'm going to stop there and have you talk back, wondering, protesting, thinking with me, thinking against me. Yes?
What you said, that scientific critique was, there was a big concern with ritual. What did they see as threatening to science about ritual?
Well, let me take the Marxists. The Marxists, who started in the 19th century, of course, but they said it was that the way churches did ritual was addictive and harming people because it claimed too much for itself. So you know, at one point, at least a third of the world was saying that together, and still a lot of it is. I mean, but I would say, yeah, there are other theories like that, but that's probably the big one that we notice and we're nervous about. I'm taking a longer time because I've said things that are worth thinking about a little bit before we go on.
I think in the mix of this, you have, and I'm thinking of the 60s, I guess, but the personal freedoms, more choice at the personal level, and so parents, you know, say, let my kid decide. So it's mm-hmm. no longer an expectation mm-hmm. that you're gonna, you know, do the tradition that we've always done.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can start to see some disintegration there where people are left to their own mm-hmm. devices, that they're not going to choose all the traditional means right. at their disposal. So I think that plays into this.
Oh, much so. And I will talk a little bit more about individualism in general, but I think that is a time when that happened. But I think you were saying that not just negatively. In other words, for my understanding is that some of that individualism helped people be better people.
I think so. Yeah.
So I'm just, in other words, but I'm just saying that is in play mm-hmm. when we think about worship and ritual. And one might say, in addition to that there was a growth of highly individual worship and ritual, where people went away from the collective character of it towards an individual.
Al?
Yes, please.
So I'm thinking about your timeline, and one of the things that has dawned on me is post-World War II, we had the development of a much bigger middle class. I'm thinking about this country. And consequently, people were economically better off. So what do you see is that, the impact of that on us?
It seemed to me that by and large, and I think for better and for worse, I think that economic well-being claimed power and authority that religion lost. I think also one could say that it allowed for a kind of education that was generally positive in all regards, both to do better worship and ritual and to choose other things than church worship and ritual.
I'm also thinking about it. Some years ago, they had a bishop from a country in Central America here preaching liberation theology as part. And I was struck by how that probably resonated with poor, you know, and oppressed people, but didn't resonate as well with me. It didn't seem to. So I wonder if, as the middle class developed and people didn't feel as oppressed, they somehow that niche of what the church had done in its past gave people other options.
I think that makes some sense, and of course a Marxist take on that is that religion and especially ritual is meant to continue to impoverish and imprison the poor. I mean that's simply a Marxist take. It's
right.
Not mine.
No.
And I refuse to say that religion and ritual and worship is for poor people.
Right.
It is for all people, I think.
But if our worship was designed around poor people or more, and as people became more affluent, is that part of what caused people to step away from it? Is that a factor in that at all, or am I
thinking
that up?
I don't see that in human history. I do see that in American history.
I heard a critique on American church history one time looking, at least considering World War II or post-World War II as a huge turning point. Her perspective was something about, you know, post-World War II, people were coming back from terrible things and looking for safety and a place where they could be with their friends. And the church filled that role. So in some ways, the church became a social club where you could be safe and be with your friends. And now we've come to a point where we don't need the church to play that role anymore. And I would argue that's not the role of the church anyway. But so now we're in this transition of trying to figure out, okay, so what is it? What does it mean to be the church? Because we don't need to be that anymore. There are many places where people find that social club aspect of life. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and I think that line of thinking is further along in Western Europe, where, yes, the full-blown ability for people to be safe in groups has been taken fully on in all kinds of other ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder how much of this is the human condition that when you're struggling, you reach out externally and internally for help, and when you're comfortable, you don't need help.
Yeah, I think that question is valid, especially for Americans.
The disease of affluenza.
There's also it's probably, it might be a small phenomena, but I've certainly observed it in my own life of my friends and talked to other people, professors who have observed it. Well, in my own life, I have a Lutheran that converted to Orthodoxy, American Baptist friends that converted to Catholicism, and a very, very close friend and spiritual director that has converted from Presbyterian to Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And one of the professors from the seminary said, well, young people are sort of tired of Christian light, meaning they're looking for that great depth that some of the ancient practices offer us. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how big that phenomenon is. But
yeah, no, I think it's significant, and I think we'll need to talk about it from some other angles as well. But for me, I will suggest a little bit later that it's the talkiness of Protestantism that has turned out not to be really powerful in the way it does worship and ritual. So it turned out that the headiness of the intellectual and the talkiness of the preacher, that wasn't able to carry the day for people's joy, sorrow, and wonder in ways that some of these other traditions still do. Okay, Christy, and then I'm going to move on.
Well, I wonder if also part of all these things that have happened in the last century, but even since the 50s, what I was saying, it seems like we've had to change our understanding of God at the core, and maybe the church hasn't kept up with having to, like an omnipotent God that allows these terrible things to happen, or a God who knows all and there's not really a lot of mysteries because now we have all these scientific explanations for mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. that God is more than our understanding, but we haven't necessarily kept that mystery and awe alive somehow to mm-hmm. keep up with other things.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very important. And I would take it in this direction. I think it's because Americans have especially felt like they could latch on to an all-powerful God that failed. So for instance, when you look at worship and ritual in many other cultures, it's not a time necessarily to be reassured that everything's in order. And we Americans really wanted not only to have everything in order, but to be on top of it. So yeah, I think that relates to God a lot, how we think of God. I'm going to say a little bit more here. I'm going to go through these next two stages and remind you right now that the next questions for all of us will be what do you know about worship and ritual that damaged you and helped you? First, I'm going to just be outrageous in all these assumptions. Just looking at the cultural trends in relationship to 2000 to 2020, in relationship to current worship trends, it just seems to me really important to notice that our materialism in our soul is still really strong. And it's now in the context of the decline of the middle class.
Could you say that again?
We're still materialist in our soul, a lot of us. And at the same time, we are, as a culture and as a nation, our middle class is falling apart. Evangelical church numbers decline now. So since 2000, almost exactly, evangelicalism, it knows it. All the demographics know it. It's in decline. At the same time as its political power is still in ascendancy. Just to say that, that so that means that in this time, the culture wars are still really strong. And they'll be simply a part of us for quite a while, even though one of the main factors in it, and I don't want to say, I don't want to blame evangelicalism for it, although sometimes I feel like it. It's really in a double bind around that, is its power is growing and its numbers are decreasing. Where you ask people why they're leaving evangelicalism, it's because of the same reason they left a lot of other churches. Sexual violence has impacted Roman Catholicism. So Roman Catholicism is in major retreat in its ability to do good worship and ritual, and it was almost always some of the best ritual that one could find, is now deeply impacted by this other kind of social crisis. Secularism, individualism, and scientism are strong and explicit in identity. That is, being secular, being an individual, and being and believing in science really helps people know who they are. None of those things are especially focused on how to do worship and ritual. Now, just rapid fire, hopefully some rapid fire. I'm going too slow. Sorry. Rapid decline in these last two decades. There's a rapid decline in worship attendance in Protestantism and Catholicism. There's a rapid decline in economic support for worship, mainly because churches have less people, less money. There's a decline in the praise band music, which just ruled the 1980s and 1990s. This has partially to do with the decline now of evangelicalism. So if you are still either happy about or sad about praise band, know it's a new day. It's not that there aren't any praise bands around, but it's really different than 20 years ago. Rapid decline in denominational identities and significant population shifts from denomination to denomination. It means so much less as to whether you are a Lutheran, a Methodist, a Congregationalist, a Presbyterian, a UCC, now than ever before. At the same time, this is one of the spookiest things I will suggest to you. There is a reemergence of church organizational emphasis on denominational doctrine and historical liturgical traditions. In other words, the denominational crowd themselves, the professional denominationalists, see that the denominations are falling apart, and their primary answer across the board is, let's learn how it really was to be a good Methodist, or a good Presbyterian, or a good Lutheran. So it's right at the same time as the populace in general says, I don't care whether I'm a Methodist or a Lutheran or not. I just want a really powerful experience. At the same time that that's doing, the people that are running the denomination are saying, get back to the old denomination. Very strong. And when you look at the last 20 years, all the denominations are trying to save themselves. Whereas all the people are saying, could you just show me a good church? There's a continued strength in Asian-based meditation practices. This is such a powerful source of help in worship and ritual for so many people in our cultures. Protestant sermon and word-centeredness is unabated. There are some people for whom that helps ritually and worship-wise, but I would say, as one who preached for the last 40 years, that the hyper focus on saying the right words in Protestant worship is one of its downfalls. I said a lot of right words. There's an eclectic and world music movements that are growing in renewed Protestant practice. So where you find, and tomorrow we'll look at a number of settings where worship is not growing just in numbers, but in its ability to bring authentic experience and energy into a place, you'll find music is turning away from hymns toward world music, towards a kind of eclectic music that's a lot of the really good eclectic music that's being written by people outside of formal religion is being grabbed by creative churches as a way to go deeper. There's a significant shift in churches toward group prayer life. That is, if you look around, even whether the churches are declining or growing, many of them are saying, preacher, stop praying. Let us pray. So it's often called the prayers of joy and concern, in which you, instead of a long prayer being offered by a pastor, the pastor turns to everybody and says, so what's on your mind and your heart? That's amazing how quickly that is growing. And I think it's a real key sign for people's thirst for worship and ritual rather than lecture and thought. Okay, so who cares whether I'm right or not on that for the moment? Let's just have some people come to speech. If you don't have a way that worship and ritual has damaged you, or don't have a way in which it has helped you, just say the one or the other, or say two together. But let's just take a moment for you to think about that. And if you only have a half a thought, I suspect it may join somebody else's half thought as we begin to think about where we are in the middle of what I tried to talk about in terms of worship and ritual. So please don't think about just going to church. Notice where you have a ritual life. If it's not church, many of you, that's your primary place for your worship and ritual life. But if you don't have one there, or you have, in addition, someplace else on the ball field or wherever, remember it and let's think about it. keep holding on to that silence as long as you need to and speak when you want.
Like a raise your hand kind of thing?
No, it's not, but go ahead.
So I grew up in the Presbyterian church. My dad was a Presbyterian minister, and I think I love the practice in service, but the things that people spoke and the way that they actually were incongruous, and so it broke my heart, actually. And for about 10 years, I left the church. I started going to women's Buddhist chapter meetings. I started following a Hindu woman. I tried the Church of Scientology. I mean, I did kind of as many different ologies as I could think of. And there were gifts. I felt like what I began to see was a common humanity that I felt like had been stripped out of the church. And then I refound it in these other places, these philosophies of thought, that then the practicing of being together and asking the questions and reflection and looking at our lives began to shift in me. And we lived at Holden 10 years ago. This is kind of after, I was even very nervous about coming to Holden because I didn't feel like, I'm not a Christian. Mm-hmm. And I was nervous about having to do the daily practice of worship here. And when I got here, they told me that my job assignment was to be worship assistant. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. So I went to the staffing people and I just said, look, I just don't think I'm your person. Like I this has been my journey. I think God's cool, but this whole Christian thing is just weird. And so they said, okay, well, why don't you just try it for 2 weeks? And we want you to be as creative as you can be, and just why don't you start with just picking out the non-religious readings for the services. And so I started reading poetry, and then within those 2 weeks, so Eric, who was the pastor at the time, he'd pick out the Bible complement to what I was picking out. And then he started saying, oh, I don't have time to do this. Can you do the biblical reading as well? And so I started opening up the book and doing all these comparisons and also just, I think, drawing upon that history of connection and disconnection. So when I was a child, the rituals around Christmas and the festivals and different stories that were read meant a great deal to me. But then when I started realizing that the adults that were there, A, didn't believe it, B, they didn't know why they were there, C, their lives, they had Sunday lives, but they didn't have, they had a Sunday life and a real life, that were not matching up, and it didn't make sense to me. And so I think partially because we worshiped every day at Holden, those things quit being incongruous here because it was a daily practice of connection and not pretense. There wasn't a lot of pretending.
Thank you. Great start.
So a lot of people know me as a big football fan here at Holden. Shocker to everybody on staff. And when you were talking about a ritual that kind of turns you, so tailgating is a huge tradition of it, and it used to be a lot of fun. And the past couple of times, for the last two seasons I actually went tailgating, I found myself dreading it, hating it more because the team had found success, so now it was cool, so everybody was doing it, and we lost the family of tailgating. Hey, come in, I could show up and not know anybody, and pretty soon you're having a smorgasbord of everything and, exchanging phone numbers and networking. And the last 2 years, there was nothing. I had 5 people I knew I could go to because they've been friends for a really long time, but there was no more of the walking along and having the, oh, hey, come in. They were much more welcoming to our opponents because, we're North Dakota nice. We got to make sure we prove that, but we don't have to be nice to fellow North Dakotans. And so I actually stopped tailgating and instead show up, unless I'm meeting somebody, 10-15 minutes before, walk into the dome, take my seat, and then enjoy the familial experience because I'm sitting with friends, and I'm thankfully my friends give me the same seats all the time, and so I sit with their friends, and like, so I know my crowd, and so that part is still a ritual for me, but I had to get rid of the ritual that wasn't feeding anything for my soul. It was actually taking away so much.
Oh, thanks so much, Sam, for just letting us remember the authenticity of all that. That's great. Yeah.
I think my experience of ritual in the church, growing up, I felt like I didn't really have a voice in the church. I was participating in ritual, but it didn't really feel like I had a role. And that probably led me to not really have any agency in my faith, and it really kind of pushed me away. And it wasn't until I worked at a summer camp and started like engaging with things, because it felt like that was welcome and also that my voice mattered, that ritual became something that I could actually participate in, that didn't feel like it was just set by a certain group of people, and that I was having to understand it, but that it would meet me where I was at. And some of the churches that, or communities that I've been able to participate since then, have been around a ritual in which is more creative, like more dialogue based, of like, let's create these rituals, and like these rituals have history and background and have meaning in that sense. And also your experience and your background also has meaning, and so that's just like opened up rituals for me of being able to honor the past but also engage in the present and the future. And that's the kind of church that I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think some rituals that we have in the village that help us, that help me take care of other people and myself, are garbo, dish team, stoking, where it matters. And it's, for me, it is more about taking care of than just doing that task. They are tasks that need to be done, but the way that we do them, we don't just have somebody whose volunteer job is to do dishes the whole time. We do it together, and you can engage with the person next to you, or you can have your head in the dish sink and not talk to anybody. And, but it's a way of being a part of and taking care of each other.
And Elaine, may I ask one question back? So being around this structure and having seen you the other night with the people who are at the bowl, can you compare and contrast what it's like to put your hand on each other's shoulder at the bowl and the candle and being in...
That too is a way of sharing in the caregiving, because occasionally you might know why you think somebody chose a bowl, but we don't ask.
Yeah.
And just standing there with them, praying over them, praying with them, is another part of that way to be together and take care of each other. Mm.
Thanks. Can I? Okay. So I think a lot of it relates back to community. Growing up, I lived in a small town. Our church was just a couple blocks from our house. And you lived in the small town, then you went to the church, then you go to school, and you see all the same people day after day. And then now we live in a larger town, like 100,000 people. And we live here, and I work over here, and then we go to church over here. So you kind of lose that community aspect. And I think a lot of that, I'd like to see if anybody studied that, like the advent of the automobile and commuting and
great,
and like the loss of community. Because at work, I don't see any church people, And then in the neighborhood, we have our own little group, but they don't work with me or go to church with me. It's like three separate areas of life, and it's just, it's interesting, and I think that happens all over the place.
Very important. So I hear harm happening with that. Being spread out, yeah.
At first I was thinking, oh, Rachel didn't harm me, but then I thought bigger. Of course it did, because growing up in the church I grew up in, there weren't women preachers, and not only that, women didn't read scripture in church. So that was something I sat at, because I went to parochial schools, I sat in that pretty much every day of my life before I graduated from high school. But then I was thinking of the way the rituals of church, and when both our moms died a few years ago, and we had, of course, there was the memorial service, was a wonderful ritual, but there was a bigger ritual of the church people taking care of you. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think, what happens if you don't have that? Because they literally, the food and, you know, just all the details of taking such good care of our families during that time. And I just don't know how do people do that if you don't have the church? I mean, we don't necessarily, I don't know that my kids will be in a church like that, though. Mm-hmm. But that was amazing to feel that. The ritual of taking care of each other in those times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that really helps, I think, all of us notice that it's not just sort of a changing of who's at the top of the baseball league as to when one loses that.
I like it to move during services, and the tradition I was raised in, we sat there the whole time. Even the communion came to us, and we never moved at all. So the Lutherans, it appealed to me, all the standing up and sitting down, just because it keeps me awake or something. But I think a multi-sensual movement, I think that's really important. So that's something I like. Rituals that you're moving.
Thank you. Paul?
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say, I think growing up, lack of access to ritual, I mean, I guess I worshiped, but it really did feel like everyone was just looking at their watch, wondering when the football game was gonna start. And then, yeah, I don't really remember much ritual growing up. And the ritual I do remember was only at a certain time, like I had to get to a certain age, then I could do that ritual for some reason that was never explained to me. And then I think my recollection is that ritual tended to be over-explained, so I wasn't given just enough to go into it and experience fear, because I was told basically everything I had to do. And, you know, then it was like, well, there wasn't much indirect transcript, or there wasn't much discrete transcript there. Later in life, though, ritual has helped me understand my relationship to other human beings, to creation, to God. And how I'm complicit in suffering of other people, beings. And yeah, I really, it's probably now benefited me more than it damaged me to begin with. But it took a long time, because I was like, well, why would I want to, you know, make a fool of myself? Why would I want to go out of a comfort zone? Why would I want to jump into something I'm kind of already afraid of? And thankfully, somebody helped me do that, because I wouldn't necessarily feel like I'd grown at all since.
Thank you.
Something I've been thinking about since yesterday when you were talking about all those, the parades or whatever they were, the celebrations, and what I'm hearing from some of what people are sharing and even thinking about myself and positive ways that I've connected with ritual and worship, whether that's through church or other non-church groups. But there's this aspect of participation, of feeling like I matter, I'm part of this, I am connected to this somehow. I mean, even in those, in the festivals from Northern Europe, that's what I was seeing too, is if everyone is out on the street, then everyone is part of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so there's a way in which, there are some ways in which some churches that, and for some people, and sometimes for myself in various places where you feel like you're just an observer and you don't feel engaged and it doesn't feel like it's, there's no ownership, there's no, this isn't, it's not really, it's not part of me, I'm not part of this, I'm just watching from the sidelines. So there's a participation factor that feels like such a huge thing where I'm connected to this because it makes me feel alive, it's, I'm participating at whatever level that is.
What a wonderful place for us to just say thank you to all of you. So tomorrow we will look at some of the ways that specific worship and ritual folks have been working on trying to keep a participation and aliveness in worship, and we'll go from there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.